Is Oklahoma smarter or just a little luckier than every other state right now? The recession is bad everywhere, but it's a little less bad in Oklahoma. The unemployment rate in Oklahoma City is still below 7%, eighth lowest in the nation. Housing values are actually up. Oklahoma City has the second lowest foreclosure rate in the country. Over in New York City, well-known financial institutions went broke. Just one bank closed in Oklahoma. Now, it's tempting to give credit to the recent boon in oil prices, and indeed, Oklahoma City is still a place where you can see an occasional oil derrick in a parking lot. The sound of Oklahoma City's future could be more like this. And that silence may be golden. It's a vacuum pump, the Edson vacuum system to be exact, made by an Oklahoma City company called OrthoCare that develops new tech prosthetic devices. Silence is one of their signatures, says their national sales manager, Jim Lagerstrom.
That's one thing as an amputee. If there's any moving parts, any noise, any clunking, any sound, you know, it can be disturbing. You know, you definitely don't want to be that person in a quiet room making noise and not being able to shut it off.
Mr. Lagerstrom tests new products for his company, too. He lost a leg 39 years ago in a snowmobile accident, but has won medals in downhill skiing in 3 Paralympic Games and competed in 5.
I also play hockey. I'm a nice, accomplished hockey player, too. I played in the 2004 World Championship hockey team tournament.
OrthoCare also has offices in Seattle and Washington, D.C., but it's moving all of its production to Oklahoma City. They say it helps to have their designers close to the production line. And the market for their technology is not restricted to amputees. Some of the technology they develop can be applied to robotic devices to be used in environments like fires, toxic zones, or bomb disposal work that would be dangerous for human beings. Oklahoma City keeps a kind of Old West identity. It's still a city where a nice dinner usually means a steak, and people go to work in cowboy boots, even if they work at a keyboard. Just this month, Forbes SmallBusinessMagazine.com pronounced Oklahoma City the top spot in the country for entrepreneurs to try to start a new business. What makes Oklahoma such congenial territory? Well, a 5.5% state income tax rate may be one reason, but Paul Risser, who runs a state endowment designed to encourage cutting-edge businesses and gave one of its first grants to OrthoCare, also cites the state's historic spirit.
There's sort of a willingness in the state of Oklahoma to try and make things happen, and I think it's in part because of this frontier spirit still in Oklahoma. We think about frontier maybe in the old sense, but the frontier today is really innovation and technology.
There's some other more traditional reasons, too, that keep Oklahoma's unemployment rate relatively low. No business is immune to recession, but Oklahoma City is fortunate to have industries that are often the last to be affected. It's the state capital, so it brims with state employees who are hard to fire without political consequences. And the state's largest employer, Tinker Air Force Base, is in town. After a General Motors plant closed down a few years ago, the county bought the plant so that Tinker could expand. Regardless of the domestic economy, international events keep the U.S. military a growth industry. Oklahoma also has a history that may have deterred local business leaders from some of the rash enthusiasms that attracted other lenders during the last generation. The Dust Bowl Depression of the 1930s, a disaster of drought and overgrazing that turned prairie into powdery soil and sent Oklahomans out of state like ants scurrying for work, for food, wrote John Steinbeck in The Grapes of Wrath. Few people alive today can remember the Dust Bowl, but no one growing up in Oklahoma doesn't feel a personal stake in that history. Larkin Warner is a professor emeritus of economics at Oklahoma State University.
That image that resulted from, particularly from Steinbeck's book, has continued to haunt us. The whole nation was full of poor rural Oklahomans who got the heck out during the Great Depression. Surprise! They had, the image of Oklahoma, it just didn't rise out of nowhere.
In the 1980s, the collapse of the Penn Square Bank, a small Oklahoma City bank that made high-risk loans to energy companies, set off a national banking crisis. Tom Honig was vice president of bank supervision of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City then.
In that period, banks failed. Businesses failed. There wasn't this too-big-to-fail environment there. Investors did lose things. It's a hard lesson, but it is a lesson that people remember, and maybe they will weather this cycle more successfully than they did the cycle in the 80s because of those hard and somewhat harsh lessons.
Mr. Honig says that harsh lesson Oklahoma banks learned 25 years ago was, don't make risky loans, which is what so many other banks did to foment the collapse of the housing industry across the country last year. And Oklahoma banks no longer invest all their assets in oil and natural gas, even when they promise the greatest return. So we asked Tom Honig. I've heard talk about a bumper sticker that was once popular in Oklahoma.
Give me a second chance and I won't blow it.
Please, God, give us another oil boom.
Yes, and I won't.
If I could get you to say it.
I can't remember it exactly.
What I'm told is it was, please, God, give us another oil boom and we promise not to piss it away.
I do remember that bumper sticker, and I wouldn't call this an oil boom. They didn't plunge into oil when it got to $140 a barrel. They didn't go and begin to speculate that it would go to $200. They were much wiser in this instance than they were in that earlier one.
15 years ago, oil and natural gas contributed 25% of the state's revenue. Now, it's down to just 12 or 13%, according to Steve Agee, an oil company executive who's also a professor of economics at Oklahoma City University.
We have diversified quite a bit since the last contraction we've had, which is good for our state, obviously.
Of course, you were still president and COO of Agee Energy, aren't you?
Yes.
And past chairman of the Oklahoma Energy Resources Board?
That's correct.
And I believe board member of the Oklahoma Independent Petroleum Association?
Right.
All of that?
Right.
Yes. Well, which is a way of asking, it's interesting that you would be talking about greater diversification of the Oklahoma City economy. It would seem that you would benefit by reliance on energy.
Well, I'm not saying that the energy industry has shrunk. I'm just saying that the Oklahoma economy has grown. So the energy industry benefits from our state growth and from the, you know, national growth and from worldwide demand for both oil and natural gas. So as we diversify our economy, that helps our energy sector as well.
So while Oklahoma City may statistically seem somewhat better off than the rest of the country right now, Oklahomans know that their present economic good fortune may be as fragile as sunny skies over an Oklahoma prairie. Clouds can roll in at any moment. Larkin Warner says,
I was talking with somebody the other day who said, you know, if we have a warm winter and that price of natural gas stays very, very low, you know, hold on. So we're hoping for a cold winter.
And there may be some reason for hope in Oklahoma. The Farmer's Almanac says temperatures this winter will be below normal, with higher than usual snowfall for most of the United States. Next week, we'll examine the local pastime in Oklahoma, weather. One man who predicts storms.
We have floods, we have droughts, we have ice storms, we have hail storms. On an average year, we have about 50 tornadoes. Back in 99, we had over 60 in one day.
And another who runs after them.
In Oklahoma, the storms usually go from southwest to northeast. So we have to go east and north to stay up with the storms. If there's a road going the direction we want to go, we'll take it, regardless if it's a dirt road or what. If it goes through, we're going to take it.
Listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
When the economic stimulus plan was working its way through Congress, it included a Buy American provision. You want stimulus money to build something? Use American steel or American textiles. Organized labor was all for it, and in no time, the provision was dropped. Economic nationalism sputtered in the face of a reality about the U.S. economy. Our country is home to so much foreign investment that working for a foreign-owned company is no longer exotic, and according to Micheline Maynard, it is increasingly attractive. Maynard is a senior business correspondent for the New York Times, and she's the author of a new book, The Selling of the American Economy, How Foreign Companies Are Remaking the American Dream. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
How big a share nowadays of the U.S. job market is, say, the total of jobs at foreign-owned companies?
There are about 5 million, a few more than 5 million jobs at foreign-owned companies in the United States. And if you think back to the discussion about saving the automobile industry, there were studies at the time that said there were about 3 million American auto jobs. So the foreign share of the American economy is almost double what the American automobile industry is.
You've actually written about four foreign-owned companies and how they operate in this country, and their experiences are actually quite different.
That's right. I write about Toyota, which is probably the one foreign company that if you ask someone who's from another country doing business in the United States, they would say Toyota. I write about EADS, which is the owner of Airbus, the aircraft manufacturer, and also a big military defense contractor. I write about Tata of India. And, you know, people don't really know what this company is, but if you drink 8 o'clock coffee for breakfast, they own 8 o'clock coffee. And the last company is Haier of China, which actually has a refrigerator factory in the Carolinas and builds all those refrigerators that kids have in their college dorms and also those wine refrigerators that people bought a lot over the last few years.
Now, getting a company like one of these to set up a factory is something that is incredibly attractive to governors. And you describe two governors incredibly different in terms of their political orientation, remarkably similar in terms of their interest to attract foreign investment.
Yes, I talk about Jennifer Granholm, who's the governor of Michigan, a Democrat supported by the United Automobile Workers, and yet she has made it her job to do a number of foreign trade missions over the years, going to places like Japan and the Middle East and Korea to find companies that will invest in Michigan. I also talk about Haley Barbour, the Republican governor of Mississippi, who really has left no stone unturned going out to look for foreign investment. I tell a story about Hurricane Katrina, which people know hit Mississippi very hard. But at the end of that week, he was already making calls to places in Japan, China, in Korea, and saying, we will be open again for business. That was how determined he was to land foreign investment.
We can understand how attractive it is to say the governor of a state to have more jobs here, jobs at a foreign-based company. Why is it so important to those companies to be here?
A couple of reasons. First of all, we're still the biggest consumer market in the world until China grows and becomes more prosperous. This is a place where everybody wants to compete. Second, despite what you might hear about American workers elsewhere, American workers have a great reputation to foreign companies. They see that you are probably cheaper to employ than especially for a European company, which pays higher wages and has higher labor costs. So American workers are attractive. Imagine if you're from Europe and you're used to a country that's filled in and you come to a place like Alabama and Mississippi and they show you acres and acres of empty land. They offer to clear it. They offer to help you with road building. I mean, for some of these companies that are used to all these restrictions and red tape, it's a dream come true.
Well, thinking ahead, I mean, do you think that the distinction between the U.S.-owned company and the foreign-owned company is obsolescent 25 years, 30 years from now? Do you think that people won't even understand what we were talking about in this conversation?
Some people will still have resistance to it because some people will always have resistance to immigration, to foreign investment in anything. You know, there are people who won't buy German cars because of what happened during World War II. But 25 to 30 years from now, if we haven't become a little bit more blind to this or at least neutral about it, and I am not saying that foreign companies are the solution to America's economic problems. I just think they're part of the solution. And that if we are going to have an economy that's open to the world, you know, let's be a little more welcoming. Let's not be as resistant to foreign companies because they might be able to teach us something and we might be able to teach them something.
Well, Micheline Maynard, thank you very much for talking with us once again.
Thank you, Robert.
Micheline Maynard is a senior business correspondent for the New York Times, and her new book is called The Selling of the American Economy, How Foreign Companies Are Remaking the American Dream.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. People need comedy during tough times, but during the great stock market crash of 1929, there was a problem. Large numbers of entertainers lost everything, too. Well, this week is the 80th anniversary of the market crash, and NPR's Robert Smith went in search of what happened to humor.
In 1929, everything was booming. The stock market, radio, movies, and riding that wave were four brothers named Marx. Groucho, Chico, Harpo, and Zeppo were even making their first talking movie about a speculative bubble, the Florida land rush.
Do you know that property values have increased 1929 since 1,000%?
You told me about this yesterday.
I know, but I left out a comma.
But the Marx brothers were obsessed with a different kind of investment. After Groucho finished filming each scene, he'd call his broker. Groucho had stuffed all of his money into stocks.
He became just your classic innocent investor. He didn't have a clue what was happening. He didn't know why the prices went up when they did.
Maury Klein is a professor of history and the author of Rainbow's End, The Crash of 1929.
Every day he'd go in and he'd look at on the big board and he'd see that his stock had climbed X number of prices. And he'd made several thousand dollars without lifting a finger. And he thought, well, this is easy.
I'll have to see my broker, find out what he can do, 'cause I'm in the market for you.
Show business and Wall Street hadn't always mixed, but by 1929, everyone was in the market. The Marx brothers were getting hot tips from Joe Kennedy. They even left an audience waiting one afternoon because they were trying to buy up shares of Anaconda Copper. You'd think they would have known better, since the entire plot of their movie, Coconuts, was about bad investments.
You can have any kind of a home you want to. You can even get stucco. Oh, how you can get stucco. Now is the time to buy while the new boom is on. Remember that old saying, a new boom sweeps clean. And don't forget the guarantee. If these lots don't double in value in a year, I don't know what you can do about it.
Groucho was very conservative. But there's this increasing belief that almost becomes a fantasy, that all you have to do is put your money in the market and the story will have a happy ending, which of course in Hollywood is supposed to happen.
But not on Wall Street. Their script called for a tragedy. Over 6 days at the end of October 1929, the stock market plunged by a third. Groucho Marx later recalled the exact words from his financial advisor. Marx, he said, the jig is up. Groucho lost $250,000. He later joked that he would have lost more, but that was all the money he had. Harpo was also wiped out. Their friend and fellow vaudevillian, Eddie Cantor, was no longer a millionaire.
Well, folks, they got me in the market just as they got everybody else. I know thousands and thousands of married men who will have to leave their sweethearts and go back to their wives.
Cantor was left with $60 in his pocket and a debt of $300,000.
Personally, I shouldn't worry about my stocks. I know my broker is going to carry me. Yes, sir. He and three other pallbearers.
Sure, it was dark, but at least they were still making jokes. You have to remember, stocks had crashed before and then gone right back up. The Great Depression was a year off, and there was still a hope that everyone could laugh this whole thing off. Singer Arthur Fields.
I'm the chump you've heard about. There's more like me, without a doubt. When stock reports are given out, oh, what a sucker. My stocks come tumbling down. My stocks come tumbling down. When I listen to the ticker tick, I figured I could get rich quick, but the bunch of bears were too darn slick. My stocks come tumbling down.
Groucho Marx still didn't think it was funny. The Marx Brothers were scheduled to do a show in Baltimore right after the crash, and Groucho couldn't go on. He was sick, depressed. The crash of 29 gave him insomnia that he never recovered from. Groucho's next movie was Animal Crackers, and you could tell the whole thing still haunted him.
Hideous stumbling footsteps creaking along the misty corridors of time. And in those corridors I see figures. Strange figures. Weird figures. Steel 186, Anaconda 74, American Can 138.
The audience would have recognized those stocks, but by the time the movie was released, Anaconda Copper had dropped even lower. It would go down to $3 a share. That's why in the movie Horse Feathers, Groucho was using the stock name as a swear word.
Jumping Anaconda!
They couldn't know it at the time, but the Marx Brothers and Eddie Cantor and the rest of the comedians would have the last laugh. The movie business was one of the few industries not devastated by the Great Depression, and the Marx Brothers' cynical brand of humor was perfect for the mood of the public. They were soon rich again. But they didn't forget. In 1937's A Day at the Races, Groucho buys into a horse-picking scam that seems awfully familiar.
Come on, you want to win?
Want to win, but I don't want the savings of a lifetime wiped out in the twinkling of an eye.
It's the one line in the movie where Groucho seems dead serious. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
Existing home sales were up better than 9% in September. Last time home sales activity was this strong, it was July 2007, well before the recession hit. Both new and existing home sales are benefiting from a government program to give first-time buyers a big tax credit, but that credit is about to expire, NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
More than 1.5 million people have taken advantage of the first-time homebuyer tax credit, staking a claim to their own $8,000 chunk of stimulus funds. Many were already planning to buy, but Lawrence Yoon, the chief economist for the National Association of Realtors, says at least 350,000 of them wouldn't have bought without the credit.
350 to 500,000 additional individual entering the market, that is having a significant impact in terms of reducing inventory and beginning to help stabilize home prices.
The first-time buyer's tax credit is kind of like cash for clunkers, but for houses instead of cars. It's giving some people that extra nudge to make a purchase they may have been on the fence about. Economist Robert Dye is with PNC Financial Services Group. He says a lot of the sales reflected in September's strong numbers were the result of people rushing to take advantage of the tax credit before it's set to expire at the end of next month.
I think without it, we will see a post-incentive letdown, just like we saw a letdown in post-cash-for-clunker auto sales.
Republican Senator from Georgia, Johnny Isaacson, has introduced an amendment to extend the credit. He says the housing market isn't strong enough to let the tax credit expire just yet.
And you're going to have it happen right at the worst time possible because December, January, and February are seasonally the lowest sale months anyway because it's the winter.
Isaacson is a former real estate agent. He's pushing to have the tax credit extended until June and expanded beyond first-time buyers. His amendment could get a vote as early as next week and has the backing of some powerful Democrats.
Although you cannot offer a tax credit ad infinitum, certainly extending it through mid-year next year and making it available to all home buyers who occupies their principal residence makes a lot of sense.
The theory is that by the middle of next year, the housing market will be more stable and sales won't hit a cash-for-clunkers-style cliff once the tax credit goes away. The Joint Committee on Taxation estimates extending and expanding the credit will cost an additional $17 billion.
You're not getting a lot of bang for the buck.
Ted Geyer is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a former Bush administration economic advisor.
Somebody needs to pull away the punch bowl a little bit. There are costs to doing all these, and we shouldn't just spend willy-nilly.
By his math, the real cost of stimulating sales in this way is more like $40,000 per home, because most of the people taking advantage of the credit would have bought anyway. Geyer says we have to be careful not to reinflate the housing bubble by pushing people that really should be renting into home ownership.
It's a legitimate goal to try and alleviate the consequences of the bursting of the housing bubble, but we really all need to be cautious about reconstituting this norm that we had before, that all policies should direct everybody into promoting home ownership at all costs.
And there's one more issue. Fraud. We learned this week that thousands of people were claiming first-time homebuyer tax credits who didn't actually deserve them, including people who already owned homes and others who didn't go through the trouble of buying a home before collecting their $8,000. Even kids as young as 4 have collected the credit. If the program is extended, the IRS says it needs new authority to crack down on fraud. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.